You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Coming up, we'll meet a pastor from Delavan who's working with the Boys and Girls Club to give teens a safe space to learn and have fun.
First, Tuesday was the deadline for those applying for candidacy in the election for Superintendent of Public Instruction in Wisconsin. Tony Evers will face two challengers in next month's primary election. Pundits say this race could turn into a partisan proxy fight over school choice expansion in Wisconsin.
Robert Menser joins us now to talk about this and other top stories from the past week in our weekly state news roundup. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Well, let's start out looking at a race a bit in the future in the spring, the race for Superintendent of Public Instruction. Tony Evers, the incumbent there, who's he going to face?
So Evers will face Dodgeville School District Administrator John Humphreys and retired Beloit Superintendent Lowell Holtz, both of whom appear to be positioning themselves somewhat to Evers' right. The State Department of Public Instruction is this race is a nonpartisan race. These elections happen in the spring in odd-numbered years, so it's really not a position that probably most people in Wisconsin will ever vote for or particularly form an opinion about. But just like every other race, it seems, oftentimes the pattern falls to political teams, right? People who's on the left and who's on the right. And Tony Evers, who's been the state superintendent since 2009, his ideas are not those of Republican Governor Scott Walker. They are much more in line with the sorts of ideas you hear from Democratic politicians.
Now, school choice has been a hot topic and also a contentious topic over the past several years. So has Common Core. What do we know about how those issues might shape this race?
Well, yes, school choice is really where it's at. So Common Core is a case where, you know, Wisconsin, like a lot of states, received federal money and incentives from the Obama administration in order to adopt this sort of common curriculum, and that became in the Obama years a flashpoint. But in practice, I think that at this point the curriculum is largely rolled into schools, and it's unlikely that despite some posturing that there's going to be drastic changes there. But school choice is a live issue, right? So Wisconsin's voucher program is statewide and is expanding. It is sort of on an elevator where each year there are more and more vouchers given out. And this is something that that Evers is, you know, he doesn't administer that policy. That's a matter of policy that state legislators can set. But he certainly has not been a supporter or vocal on the idea of expanding that. And that is different than his opponents. They both have been very critical of public schools, especially in urban areas in the state, and definitely in favor of expansion of the voucher program.
So, Rob, given that flashpoint of school choice, does this race, even though it's a race that takes place in the spring, doesn't typically draw a ton of attention, could this have the potential to draw some national attention or at least some outside money?
Without a doubt, there will be outside money. So school vouchers have a large infrastructure in the conservative world for multiple reasons. I mean, for ideological reasons, there are conservatives see that as a beneficial education policy. It's worth saying the incoming Donald Trump's nominee for National Education Secretary is known as a massive funder of candidates supporting school choice or school vouchers, as you wish, I think for sure there's also the fact that a lot of these are private companies, and there is a lot of money in the world of private schools, and certainly in lobbying for private school vouchers. So yeah, without a doubt, the onslaught is coming. We will see outside spending in this race aimed at that specific issue.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, that's based in Wausau. And we're checking out the top news stories in Wisconsin this week. And Rob, Tuesday was the deadline for filing in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, and Justice Ziegler up for another 10-year term, and nobody showed up to oppose her. What happened?
Yeah, this is one, you could either look at it as, we're dodging a bullet, because these races get, the Supreme Court races in recent memory have been extremely ugly and sort of gross. On the other hand, you know, for those on the Democratic Party side or folks who are more liberal, this is a large institutional failure. And Ed Ziegler is squarely within the court's conservative majority. Unseating her would not change the sort of balance of power of the court, but Supreme Court terms are 10 years long in Wisconsin, and so to not even have a candidate to challenge the incumbent is seen as a missed opportunity if you're a progressive.
And we're going to move on to another story now. This week, the Wisconsin Department of Transportation found a traffic deaths increased by almost 6% in the year 2016. What happened with the increase in fatalities there?
Well, there were 588 traffic deaths in 2016. It's 33 more people than died in 2015. And it's a concern. It's the highest rate since 2012. It's also above the 5-year average that the department uses to make sure it's, you know, just look at outliers. So it could be an outlier, but what it seems to be is that there seems to be a pretty straightforward explanation for this. People are driving more. When you drive more, you are more likely to die in a car crash. The factors that contribute to people driving more are relatively low gas prices in 2016 and especially a relatively strong economy. When there's better economy, people drive to their jobs or travel in cars more. And both of those factors were specifically cited by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation as an explanation for this increase in deaths.
We also raised the speed limit by 10 miles an hour. Is that part of this?
So it had to be a factor. 2016 was the first full year that Wisconsin had 70 miles per hour speed limits on highways. This was passed in 2015, and for sure speeding contributes to a lot of traffic deaths, and for sure crashes that occur at higher speeds are more likely to be deadly. So it's reasonable to, you could infer that if on average people are driving faster, then that probably is one factor in this in the increase.
And our last story today, yesterday CBD oil was in the news in Wisconsin. And first of all, Rob, what is CBD oil?
So this is it's a derivative of marijuana. So this is medicinal marijuana. It is used to help people who suffer from seizures. But it's a very specialized byproduct. It does not have a significant amount of THC, which is the main thing in marijuana that actually allows people to get high from marijuana. So it's not really a drug, as the advocates say. It's not really a drug that anyone would use for recreational purposes, but it is something that's effective for people who have seizures, for preventing seizures. So this is not the first time that this has been considered in Wisconsin. Last year, the Assembly passed a bill that would have legalized the use of this substance with a prescription, but that died in the Senate. It's seen as a humanitarian policy because there are actual cases where this helps people, including children. But it's also seen, I think not incorrectly, as kind of a first step on the path to broader types of marijuana legalization. And that is what defeated it last year. But it sounds like maybe there's some thaw in that. One of the senators who opposed it said she might be open to it this year, the legislative leaders seem to signal that it would go forward. So it is a thing to look for in this year's session.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks.
That was Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He's with us every Friday for our weekly state news roundup.
Kids around the state are getting back in the swing of the school year at the end of the winter break. For some families with teens, the school day raises a concern, a gap between the end of the school day and the end of the parents' work day.
Our next guest says that after school gray areas was when he got into trouble as a middle school student in Delavan. Now he's a pastor serving his hometown, and he's working to meet the needs of teenagers there and give them an after-school space to learn and have fun.
Jeff Contreras is the pastor at the Rock of Jesus Apostolic Church in Delavan, and he's the program director for the Boys and Girls Club in Walworth County. The chapter is just a few years old. He says the group is still looking for community volunteers and financial support to serve as many kids as possible. I talked to him yesterday morning. Pastor Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, let's talk about some of the challenges facing kids in Walworth County. A lot of times we hear about kids in urban areas. What do you see there? What are some of the biggest needs for kids in your area?
Well, you know, in Delavan, particularly right now, that's where the club's located. We are open to all kids in all of Walworth County, but specifically in Delavan right now, a lot of our kids just don't really have much to do. They have a lot of unsupervised time after school. You have the kids that are in sports and after school activities, which is great, but that's a small population of the kids here in Delavan or in the surrounding areas. And so a lot of these kids just have a lot of free time, and some of them, quite a few of them, are either in single-parent homes or, you know, even what you might call broken homes, or they might be in foster care or something along those lines. But a lot of those kids don't have the support system at home or even just the supervision, you know, to kind of keep an eye on them. So a lot of our kids kind of find their way into trouble after school because there's not really a lot to offer right now other than the Boys and Girls Club.
And the Boys and Girls Club is fairly new. I understand your wife was one of the people, the person who got the ball rolling. What got the Boys and Girls Club started there in Delavan?
Well, actually, my wife is the single person who started by herself way back when. We got married about 9 years ago, and when she moved here, she's from Madison, and I'm from Delavan. I've lived here my whole life. When she moved here, one of the first things she said to me, she said, "Is there a Boys and Girls Club here?" And I said, "No." And she was shocked. And she said, "Well, I'm going to start one." And I kind of honestly laughed it off a little bit because I lived here my whole life. And as kids growing up, we always talked about wanting a club, but nothing ever happened. So when she said it, I kind of had the good luck mentality. But my wife is a very determined woman, and she's a hard worker. And so once she made up her mind she was going to do it, she contacted the Boys and Girls Club of America, and she basically asked them, you know, what do I need to do to qualify to get a club started? And that's kind of where she began.
From that starting point, what was the community response? Did people say, "Yeah, we do need something like this"?
Yeah, it was really great. It was positive right from the get-go. We had a lot of figures, you know, including the mayor and a lot of people that worked at bigger companies here in the area. They responded immediately. They were very excited, and it didn't take very long. She had to put together what they call the advisory council. That's kind of how BGCA works. That's one of the first steps. But she put together a council, a team of about 8 to 10 community members, you know, influential members, and they that team was put together relatively quickly, and they were all on board. They were very excited, and it didn't take much time to get the buzz going in the area.
And what kind of activities do you provide then at the club?
Well, we have a variety of program activities. That's actually my specific function, my job there as the program director, and we offer academics, which is the one program we do every day. Every day we have different activities. We give the kids variety, but the one thing that's a staple that we don't compromise on is homework and reading, which is nice because we do that every day the club's open. The kids come in, they get a snack, they do their homework right away. That way they can go home and tell their mom and dad, "Hey, I don't have any homework." They can have fun, do whatever. But after homework and reading, there's a variety of activities and programs that we offer. We want to encourage things like arts, culture, diversity, even career focus. And then obviously we add in a lot of sports and fitness activities to try to promote healthy living style for the kids.
What kind of reaction are you getting from the kids? Do you see this making a difference?
Yes, I have definitely seen a huge difference since I came on board. Initially, my wife, this was her dream job. She started the club with the hopes of being a program director herself. But right when the club was about ready to open, we were having our first child, my daughter, Abigail. And when my wife got pregnant, her whole focus, her whole mindset shifted in life. And she really wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, and I agreed 100%. And so I really was just a cheerleader in the beginning for my wife just to get the club started. But once the club opened, they hired a program director, and things didn't necessarily work out the way they had hoped, and that was the first year. And so then they came to me, and they were just kind of like, you know, we need someone we can trust. We need someone that's from the area, that's passionate about it. And they just wanted me to give it a shot. I was a little hesitant because I'd never worked at a Boys and Girls Club before, but my wife persuaded me to give it a shot. She was confident I would do well. And so when I came on board, it's been amazing to see the progress just in 2 years. Our attendance has continued to go up, and the relationship that I and the staff have with the kids is just tremendous. These kids, the more and more kids that come, you know, what's happening is the current members we have, or the repeat members, the members that were there a year or two ago, are then telling their friends how great the club is, and we're starting to see that these kids are really responding to us. You know, not even just, you know, the activities are fun, we take field trips and all that, but more than anything, I would say it's the relationship they're having, the positive relationship they're having with the staff. You know, we really care for them, we're really there for them, and, you know, they're really bonding with us, and it's showing.
We're talking to Pastor Jeff Contreras. He's with the Boys and Girls Club of Walworth County. He's in Delavan. And you mentioned growing up in Delavan, and there wasn't something like this. And I understand you had your moments of trouble as a youth.
Yes, I definitely did. It's funny because I'm in the middle school now, and that's where the current club is located. And it was literally at that time of my life. I was always a good kid. I always got good grades. I was an athlete year-round. But when I got to middle school, late about sixth grade year, the end of my sixth grade year, I just kind of got exposed to drugs and alcohol and things of that nature. And, you know, I always stayed involved in sports, and I always stayed involved with academics, and I kept my grades up. But from middle school on, you know, I kind of lost my way, and I made a lot of poor decisions, made a lot of mistakes. Thankfully, I'm still here, and I turned things around. But I remember specifically, and I know if any of my friends I grew up with are listening to this, I remember specifically 6th, 7th, 8th grade, we were always talking about, man, I wish I had a club. I wish we had somewhere to go. I wish we could go play basketball somewhere. We could go hang out. And so I know definitely as a young person in this community, there was a need back then. And obviously, you know, fast forwarding to now, the need is just as great, if not greater.
Do you use your own experiences when you talk to the kids in the Boys and Girls Club?
Oh, yes, definitely. I would say almost on a weekly basis. We have one program activity that's called group talk, and sometimes we separate the kids into smaller groups. Sometimes we keep them together in a bigger group. But a lot of those group talk sessions, the staff will go first just to kind of encourage the kids and give them some confidence so they're comfortable talking. But almost every time we have a group talk session, I'll usually start and I'll open up. And I'll tell them, you know, very personal things. I'll tell them very specific things about what happened to me in my past and how I grew up, because it's really powerful in relating to them, you know, because right now they look at me as Mr. Jeff. Some of them even call me Pastor Jeff because they know I'm a pastor. You know, they look at me as this, you know, quote unquote, got it together guy who's responsible and living the, you know, the good life. And I try to make them realize, you know, guys, I have been through a lot of things that are very similar to what you're going through right now. And then when the staff members go after me, a lot of their stories are very similar. So it really helps with that bonding process and the trust that the kids give us.
We hear a lot about people not being connected and engaged with their communities. You're a person, you're in the place you grew up, you're a pastor, a faith leader, you're involved with Boys and Girls Club, your wife was the spark plug that made it happen. What makes you so community-minded?
You know, this is going to sound funny, but growing up, I had a great mother. I hope she's listening. My mother is very unselfish, very loving, and very giving, and I have a great father as well. But growing up, I was pretty selfish. I was pretty self-centered. I really only cared about me and what I wanted to do. And, you know, when I gave my life to God and when I became a Christian, I was in my junior year in high school about, I just really kind of realized how selfish I was, and I didn't like it. I felt like I was a pretty ugly person. And I realized little by little, as I began to try to focus on other people and help others, it was so much more fulfilling than just striving for what I wanted. And, you know, I always remember when I was younger, I used to say I was going to move away. You know, once I graduate high school, I'm going to go to college somewhere far away, and I'm never coming back. But, you know, obviously, I'm still here. It totally changed. It totally shifted. When I got rid of that selfish perspective, my heartbeat was here at home because I knew so many people. I mean, I grew up, Delvin's a kind of a small town, and you know everybody. You go to Walmart, you can't get out of there in an hour because you run into 25 people, you know. But as I got older, I began to realize, man, I know so many people here, so many families, and the least I can do with the time I've got on this earth is to try to give back to them, to show them that I care, to show them that I love them. Because honestly, I don't feel like I did a good job of that in my earlier years of my life. So, you know, I guess I'm trying to make up a little bit for some of them foolish years back when I was younger.
Suppose somebody's out there listening. They're in a community. Maybe it's Delavan. Maybe it's Milwaukee. Maybe it's, you know, up north somewhere. They know there's a need in their community, and they're wondering when somebody's going to come along and fix it. Do you want to give them a pep talk to maybe be that person?
Yeah, I would say you just got to start somewhere. And I know it's cliche. People hear that all the time. But really, you know, my wife is the perfect example of this. You know, here I lived here, and I'd love to take credit, but I can't. You know, I lived here my whole life, and I hate to say it. I kind of had given up hope that there would be a club like this. But here comes my wife, who's not even from the area, but she sees the need. She immediately sees the need, and she cares. And I know there's people out there listening right now in their communities that care. You just got to find one or two other people in the community that have the same mindset and the same goals. And then from there, you know, there's help and support out there. You know, my wife, she just contacted BGCA, and she got hooked up with the club next door in Janesville. And that's all it took to get the ball rolling. So I think a lot of times people feel discouraged and they almost feel like they're alone. But I'm telling you, if you start talking to individuals, you know, at establishments, at businesses, at schools, you're going to find eventually a handful of people that care just like you do. And then you just got to get hooked up with somebody who's already done it. You know, don't try to reinvent the wheel. Just find somebody else in a neighboring community that has something going that you like or that you want to try to model. And I guarantee you they're going to be willing to help you out because that's basically what happened here.
Pastor Jeff, thank you so much for taking this time.
Thanks again for having me. It was a great opportunity. I really appreciate it.
That was Pastor Jeff Contreras of Delavan, where he's the program director for the Boys and Girls Club of Walworth County. For more information and to find out how to get involved, there's a link to the Boys and Girls Club of Walworth County website on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7 is Ken Rudin's Political Junkie with a countdown toward the inauguration of Donald Trump and a look at the big issues shaping up for 2017. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, a national conversation about race, hate crimes, and politics has erupted around 4 African-American men and women facing felony charges in Chicago. They're arrested after a Facebook Live video showed them beating a white student who police said had mental health issues. The video also recorded the attackers shouting expletives about President-elect Donald Trump and about white people.
The victim is now at home with his family and is expected to recover from his injuries. The Chicago police held a press conference on the investigation yesterday. Here's a clip of Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson from yesterday's conference.
I'm pleased to announce that the investigation has concluded and charges have been approved by the Cook County State's Attorney for hate crimes, aggravated kidnapping, aggravated unlawful restraint, and aggravated battery with a deadly weapon against all 4 of the offenders in custody.
That was the Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson listing the charges of the 4 attackers that they're now facing.
The case has sparked conversations beyond Chicago and across the nation and on social media. Brian Levin joins us now to talk to us about the impact the viral video of this attack could have and about hate crime laws in general. He's a hate crime analyst and he directs the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a lot of fun to be on your show, though, not with respect to this topic, obviously.
Right. And talk about what it means for this case that the 4 attackers who posted themselves on video were charged with a hate crime.
Well, Wisconsin, interestingly enough, is the national leader with respect to hate crime laws, in part because your law was litigated before the United States Supreme Court back in the Wisconsin versus Mitchell case in 1993, where I actually wrote a couple of briefs. In any event, the hate crime designation actually does not significantly increase the penalty in this case because there's a kidnapping and an aggravated battery charge already in there. So depending on how this thrashes out under Illinois law, where you have to have an underlying crime. So similar to Wisconsin, we have what's called a penalty enhancer. So in this case, the underlying crimes are so significant that we're talking about possible decades in prison.
Right. So in that case, the hate crime charge may not add that much to the punishment. In some other cases, if it was a lesser assault without this kind of kidnapping charge, can hate crimes make a bigger difference in terms of a prison sentence?
Yes, absolutely. And that's where we see the most impact. In fact, in most instances, hate crime offenses are not actually charged, even though the case seemed like a hate crime and was even labeled as one for data collection purposes, because the Supreme Court has held in another case called Apprendi out of New Jersey that a jury or judge must find beyond a reasonable doubt the bias selection. So with regard to Wisconsin's law, the law actually says the intentional selection of a victim because of various status characteristics. Illinois says that as well. Their language is a little different. Illinois' hate crime law talks about if that bias is a motive, but it can be a motive in combination with others as well that need not be hate motivated. And that's pretty much similar to what you have with Wisconsin. It's just not stated explicitly.
Is the term hate crime a little misleading when it comes to the law? You don't have to prove a condition of hate, an emotional state. It sounds like it's more about, as you just said, the selection of a victim based on particular defined types of bias.
Absolutely. It's the intentional selection. And indeed, one of the first cases, if not the first case, prosecuted by the federal government involved feuding Amish people who had different interpretations of the faith. So in that case, there might not have been hatred. It might have even been a dispute over what the proper philosophy should be in ritual. But nevertheless, it was prosecuted as a federal hate crime. Just so I can actually fully answer your previous question, the times where these charges make the most difference is when you're going from a high misdemeanor to a low felony, because then you can get more than a year in prison. Indeed, in Wisconsin's case, Wisconsin versus Mitchell, the fellow directed a crowd to attack a child on the basis of his race, in this case a white child. And he could have gotten 4 years. He got 2 years out of the 4 years and then an additional penalty, but he could have gotten a total of 7. So in that case, a couple of years was added to that defendant's case, and that's right out of Wisconsin. So to give you an idea, when something's a felony, it can hike the punishment for a felony, but it really makes a difference for those high misdemeanors.
Talking to Brian Levin from California State University San Bernardino about hate crimes in the aftermath of this attack that is really, sadly, gone viral, this attack in Chicago. Hate crimes charges filed along with assault and kidnapping charges against the four alleged perpetrators. We're going to call her now at 800-642-1234. Bob has a question. He's in Milwaukee. Bob, hi.
Hi, thanks. I was just wondering, white people are not subject to the same racisms and problems that people of color have experienced. Are the hate crimes differently applied, so to speak, to white people in this situation as opposed to people of color?
Bob, thanks for the call. Brian, how does that play out in law and in practice?
What a great question. And it was actually, for those of you who actually read this stuff, I hope not. But anyway, there was a Yale Law Review article over 20 years ago that stated we should only protect people who come from historically discriminated upon groups. Of course, they acknowledged that would be totally unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which is all persons born and naturalized in the United States are entitled to the equal protection of the laws. Interestingly enough, though, as a matter of statistical practice, African Americans remain the most targeted people for hate crime across the United States for every year that we've had data out of the FBI. Now, of course, the data it has some flaws, but I think that tells us something. Right now, about 29.5% of the attacks in 2015, as recorded by the FBI, were against African Americans. About 10.5% were against white people. And over the last decade or so, we've seen the range of anti-white attacks to be around 8 to 11%, give or take. There's sometimes about 11.3% in that range. The Anglo-white population as of 2015 in the United States is 61.3%. So you're much more likely to be attacked if you're African American, because they are about 13% of the population. But even in a descending numerical set, in other words, African Americans are being attacked less relative than they were a decade ago, they're still 29.5%, so that's more than double their representation of the population. Jews, the number one target for religious hate crimes, with about 11 or 12% in any given year, and that's declining as well. It was up last year. Muslims, this is what's interesting. Muslims have really jumped with regard to the number of attacks that they faced last year. They went from about 2.6 to 2.8% of hate crime victims, and now they're about 4.4%.
But by the law, as I understand it, it doesn't matter what race or religion you are. If that was the defining factor, if that was why you were selected for the attack, that could be called a hate crime, whether you're white or not.
Absolutely, and as it should be. Although, unfortunately, yes, we do have a terrible history with regard to racism against African Americans, but the Constitution at this point has to be colorblind because I think of common sense and the 14th Amendment.
Now, getting back to this case, this assault in Chicago, there's a question. It looks like the hate crime, they're not applying it because of the racial motivation, at least the racial statements videoed in this attack, because of the disability status of the attack victim.
That's right. And, you know, we often see like intersecting identities. So, for instance, some states have gender listed and sexual orientation, and depending on how the attack goes, you could do one or the other. But the bottom line here is under the law in Illinois, what has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt is that bias selection took place. And you can have intersecting identities and intersecting motives. Indeed, the Illinois law explicitly references that. So the way they prosecute it, we'll see. But they could go either way on an anti-white attack or an anti-disability attack. One more quick thing, because this is public radio and you have the smartest listeners. Don't forget that you can also charge vulnerable victim statutes. Many states like California, and I believe Wisconsin does, but I would have to double check, has a vulnerable victim statute. And here in California, for instance, if you attack someone because of their disability, that can be charged under a vulnerable victim statute, which might be a little easier to prosecute because all you have to show is that the victim had that disability and therefore was vulnerable, and not prove the motive.
We're talking to Brian Levin. He's a hate crime analyst and attorney. We're looking at hate crime laws as four African Americans in Chicago face felony charges and the hate crime enhancer. A Facebook Live video showed them beating a white person with mental health issues while shouting racial slurs at him.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what you think of the attackers being charged with a hate crime. And what do you think of hate crime laws? Do you think they're needed to deter attacks based on race, disability, gender, and other factors? Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing the conversation with hate crime analyst and attorney Brian Levin. We're talking about hate crimes and hate crime laws after four people in Chicago were charged with felonies and hate crimes after an attack broadcast live on Facebook.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Does the attack affect how you see race relations in the country today? Do you think states and the federal government should have hate crime laws in place? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We just got word that a judge has denied bail for the four alleged attackers. Brian, I want to get into the impact a video like this has on how we think of race and hate crimes in the United States. It's dramatic. Information is coming out a little at a time. False information has been added to the story as it's spread online. What are your thoughts on that?
Welcome to 2017. I think one of the interesting aspects of this is the social media component all the way around. Let's step back a second. About 48.5% of hate crimes are committed by the ones where we know the offenders are committed by white people, about 24% are committed by African Americans. African Americans are 13% of the population, and Anglo whites are 61%. But let me step back. That's only criminal data. One of the things that we've seen, and this has taken place across racial and ideological lines, and this is, I think, a big headline, and that is, intergroup conflict today is not just occurring under the traditional lines that we've seen, black and white, et cetera, et cetera. L.A. County, for instance, 90% of the racial hate crimes are by and between people of color. So as America diversifies, so too do hate offenders. There was a string of swastikas across Long Island, New York recently, and it was done by a South Asian person. So we're really seeing a democratization of hate. And I think part of this is due to social media, because methods now don't just get contained to one part of the web or one ideology. So the coarseness that exists in society has jumped over fire lines across all different groups, unfortunately.
I want to talk about the intent of hate crime legislation, Brian. As I understand it, it is in part to say certain crimes are trying to discourage certain groups from participating fully in society. And, you know, going back to the heyday of the Ku Klux Klan and lynchings of African Americans, trying to keep people from participating in the economy, to try to participate in politics and elections. Is that part of what hate crime laws are trying to prevent?
Traditionally and historically, that's exactly the case. And indeed, federal law, because of a variety of constitutional technicalities, made it such that you not only had to prove a racial or some other group-based motive, but also the interference with a particular right, such as voting or sitting on a jury. That federal law came into effect in 1968, after the civil rights struggles. But the earlier laws came about right after the Civil War. But in any event, what we saw during the 1980s were hate crime laws really get enacted as part of an overall awareness of the diversification of society, victims' rights, as well as quality of life oriented statutes. So it was a mix of civil rights, but other types of developments that were going on within the criminal justice system generally. Bottom line, though, the Supreme Court has said that discrimination is something that the government has an obligation to eradicate. And one of the ways that discrimination can be embedded is not just through bad laws or business practices where people aren't allowed to use certain facilities, but also through threats of violence. So if someone's moving into a neighborhood, for instance, or taking a job. So what hate crime laws have done has really broadened the opportunity for criminal prosecution in those cases where violence is used on the basis of group status, without having to get into the details that you had spoken about eloquently just a minute or so ago, interfering with a particular right. Now, hate crime laws just look at the discriminatory selection of victims, because really when we have hate crimes, it's preventing people from fully participating in civil society.
Talking to Brian Levin from California State University, San Bernardino, talking about hate crimes and hate crime laws. We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mac is with us in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I'm just calling because I guess it's obvious to me that, well, the realities that Brian is speaking to, that things are more complicated than they seem. It really strikes home with me because I think obviously we want to punish heinous crimes, and crimes are more heinous when they're committed against someone for seemingly no reason or a reason like an identity. But we want to be careful that just because we have a hammer, not everything is a nail. And with the expansion of prisons, I think hate crimes, labeling something a hate crime and putting someone in prison for longer and not acting towards reconciliation or trying to ameliorate the broad societal problems that maybe cause some of these things and causing more problems by locking people up for longer and costing states and the government money in that sense is something that our historically hard on crime government has been able to agree on.
Mac, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Brian?
What did I say before about you having the smartest listeners? People's Exhibit A. Here's the thing. I think that there's an excellent case for what your caller said. Indeed, people of color tend to be disproportionately punished in our criminal justice system. However, here's the thing. We have the moral rectitude to be able to say that these crimes pose a unique harm to civil society. And indeed, the Supreme Court has upheld these laws on that basis, that legislatures have the right to determine these conclusions. How you go about it is another thing. And I've seen hate crime victims who have reached out to offenders. A mosque in Connecticut, for instance, forgave their attacker, and he's a reformed person. So I think that's right. But I think the government should have the ability to, for these worst cases, use the hate crime laws when they're fitting. As a practical matter, most hate crimes are not prosecuted under hate crime laws. It's much more the exception rather than the rule. But I think there's something to be said for a moral statement to be made by the government and by society as to how certain types of crimes, because of their nefarious motive and their divisive effect on society, should be punished more.
Mac, I want to jump in, Brian. Yeah. Mac, thanks for the call. I want to get in one more quick call with
sure.
Wes in Winona, Minnesota. Wes, hi.
Yeah, hi.
What do you think?
Well, here, for the sake of argument, I want to ask you this. Why is, and it sounds maybe silly on the surface, but why should we have to have another layer? Why should we have hate crimes? What's wrong with the code system now, the laws? I do something, say to somebody, and beat them up, and it's 5 years in prison. Oh, but you did it because he was black, or because he was white, or something. Oh, we're going to add 2 more years, so 7. Why aren't the laws enforced in such a way that it's 7 years anyway?
Wes, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Brian in. This is a common argument against hate crime laws. Murder is murder. Kidnapping is kidnapping. Charge them the same way either way. As we wrap up, Brian, what do you think?
Well, a couple quick points. Number one, hate crimes have been demonstrated by research, and that, we put that in the U.S. Supreme Court briefs, that, and the Supreme Court has held that legislatures think that they're more likely to result in retaliatory attacks. For instance, criminologically, they're more likely to be directed against persons. When they involve assaults and batteries, they're more likely to involve hospitalization. They're harder to solve. So there are objective criminological reasons that make these crimes more risky and severe. But what I would also say is the law also looks at target and motive traditionally. This isn't something new. Being disorderly on an airplane is being different than being disorderly on a street corner. Assaulting a firefighter while fighting a fire is different than assaulting someone who's not. So the law makes distinctions with regard to target and motive all the time. And one of the reasons that we have hate crime laws is because oftentimes they're committed serially with escalating severities, and at the lower end, they're not being deterred.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Brian Levin. He directs the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino.